Let's take our Bibles. We'll go to Exodus chapter 23 this morning. Exodus chapter 23. So we are about done with what's called the Book of the Covenant. It's that section of three chapters right after the giving of the Ten Commandments and just before the time when basically God and Israel take their oaths, their vows of fidelity, if you will. Exodus chapter 23, we're going to be looking at verses 10 down through verse 19. Exodus 23, beginning in verse 10, the Bible says, "For 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield. But the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the beasts of the field may eat. You shall do likewise with your vineyard and with your olive orchard. 6 days you shall do your work, but on the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your donkey may have rest, and the son of your servant woman, and the alien may be refreshed. Pay attention to all that I have said to you. Make no mention of the names of other gods, nor let it be heard on your lips. 3 times in the year you shall keep a feast to me. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. As I commanded you, you shall eat unleavened bread for 7 days at the appointed time, in the month of Abib, for in it you came out of Egypt. None shall appear before me empty-handed. You shall keep the feast of harvest, of the first fruits of your labor, of what you sow in the field. You shall keep the feast of ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather in from the field the fruit of your labor. 3 times in the year shall all your males appear before the Lord God. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with anything leavened, or let the fat of my feast remain until the morning. The best of the first fruits of your ground you shall bring into the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk." This morning, I've entitled the message, "Take Time to Be Holy." As we come to the end of this Book of the Covenant, as God's taken some time to lay out and to illustrate and to put flesh on the commandments that he's given, what he does as he wraps things up here is he starts to help them to understand that his whole point is to help them to order their life around the one who gives them life, and life that is abundant. Again, we know where we're at, and we're going to be here through the rest of the book of Exodus. But God has brought out a community that corporately he's redeemed. He brought them out the night of the Passover, in which that lamb was slain and the blood was put on the doorposts. All of them had to dwell inside that house, that dwelling, where they walked through the blood that was put on the doorposts. And then as God passed through, the death angel passed through the land of Egypt, he saw the blood on the doorposts and he passed over all who were under the blood. And it was that people that God brought out. He redeemed them at an exorbitant price. All of the firstborn of the land of Egypt. The life for life of an innocent lamb, a spotless lamb, a young innocent lamb for every one of their own firstborn. He brought them out and he brought them to this place where he's going to make them not just a redeemed community, but a covenant community. He's going to enter into with them in a covenant. A covenant that will bind him to act in a certain way. And it will bind them to him to act in a certain way. He's making this covenant with them as he gets ready to bring them, not just out of Egypt, but into a promised land. And it's here at Mount Sinai where he's giving them their core values. The value of holiness. They are to be holy because they represent a holy God. A covenant with a core value based on grace, that everything they have, they didn't earn, but it was given to them by God. And God builds in, as we're going to see this morning, he builds into the very fabric of their lives, into the very fabric of their economy, the very fabric of the way they keep time, this idea of grace, that I can't do what only God can do for me. And then the last of the Ten Commandments, as we treat each other with love, this neighbor society in which My welfare is tied and connected to the welfare of my neighbor. That's why we don't take advantage of each other. Love does no ill to his neighbor. The book of Romans summarizes it that way. We saw just after the giving of the Ten Commandments, at the very end of chapter 22, that God begins this book of the covenant by emphasizing worship. He's going to wrap up this book of the covenant once again by emphasizing worship. When we first saw this, the initiation of this section of the book of Exodus, we see that God is on the mount with the fire, the trumpet, the smoke, and his presence would consume even his people, except they enter his presence by means of the mediator and by means of the altar. Those are the only two ways even God's people can enter into God's presence. And then for the next several verses, the next couple chapters, he takes time to lay out some laws, laws that keep everything in balance. We saw that justice is executed in the context of liberty. These are meant to be free people, not people who are slaves anymore, but freed to be what God created them to be. But they exercise even their liberty in the context of justice, that they're thinking of each other, even as they exercise their own rights. We saw last week the whole idea of ethics, where their greatness would only be in proportion to their goodness. And so God teaches them an ethic. And he says, I want you to stand out as my people, but you must learn to stand up for that which is good as my people. As we come to this section this morning, what we're going to focus on once again, because God focuses on it, as he wraps up this, what's called the Book of the Covenant, he drives home once again the essential nature of worship. And he ties it in with time. In my office, I have this clock on the wall. You can't read it very well there, but it says, time is the most valuable thing that one can spend. Time is the most valuable thing that one can spend. What God is going to do in this portion of the book of Exodus is he's going to tie up their time with him. And the reason he does that is because worship is that regular time with God that lifts us routinely above the towering circumstances of life. There will be plenty of reasons, plenty of excuses, plenty of opportunity for not just God's people then, but God's people now, to be dissuaded from our high calling, to get discouraged as we run the race that's set before us, because our eyes aren't looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, but we're like Peter. When Peter lifts up his eyes and he sees the waves, gets his eyes off of Jesus, and our hearts are filled with anxiety. And as God brings to a close the application, the very rubber meets the road application of what these Ten Commandments are supposed to draw down for these people, he reminds them that the most practical thing that they can do, the most practical way they can be equipped to be what he's called them to be, to do what he's called them to do, is as they don't look at the circumstances around them, but rather they lift their eyes to the one who redeemed them, who called them, who separated them, who sanctified them to himself. And worship, he's weaving into the very time, the calendar of their year. We're going to look at three separate times. The first is once every 7 years. We call it a sabbatical. Okay? Once every 7 years, they're supposed to set aside time. On a smaller scale, once every 7 days, they're supposed to set aside time. And then the third circumstance, we look at three times every year. They're supposed to set aside time. All of these are with a focus on God. All of these are meant to stop what they're doing, to set their lives apart, and to retune their instruments so that they can play the tune they're called upon to play. There's two reasons this morning that we need to worship God routinely. The first is this. It takes time to understand that the abundant life is contingent upon our personal efforts in obedience. In verses 10 through 13, he's going to focus on the fact that they have some obedience, and this obedience is going to require time. It's going to require some effort on their part. We see first in verses 10 and 11 that this obedience is a costly obedience. It's going to be an entire year that he requires of them. See there in verse 10, "For 6 years you sow your land and gather in its yield, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow." This is an inconvenience, to say the least. Well, it's a convenience in that you don't have to work it. But what are you going to do without the increase of that field? Now that's an inconvenience. For 6 years, they've been economically banking, literally, on that field producing for them. And it's a routine. You sow your field, you take in its yield. You sow your field, you take in its yield. You sow your field, you take in its yield. You punch the clock, you clock out, you clock in, you clock out, you collect your paycheck. It works pretty good. And God says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to not clock in, and I want you to not collect a paycheck. Exodus has no relevance to us today, does it? Well, let's put it in modern terms. I want you to not clock in and not collect a paycheck. Wait a minute. I'm not on board with that. That's not very exciting. That's not how I want things to work. God says that's how I want things to work. I want you to understand that your life isn't primarily about clocking in, clocking out, and collecting a paycheck. That's why he says up in Matthew chapter 6, I don't want you to focus on the things that everybody else focuses on, the Gentiles. I don't want you to think about what you're going to eat. I don't want you to have to focus about what you're going to wear. I don't want you to have to focus on what you're going to drink, where you're going to live. I want you to understand that I am the one who is able to take care of you, and not just able, but both willing and wanting to take care of you. The only way I can do that is to make you carve time out of this pattern of economic increase, of sowing and reaping, and sowing and reaping, in order to remind you that your life is more than just clocking in, clocking out, and collecting a paycheck. It says, so that the land may have rest. And not just the land, but the vineyards and the orchards. The idea is the fields where the grain would grow, the vineyards where the grapes would be produced, and then the orchard where the olives would grow and the oil would be pressed. Every aspect of their life, commercially, agriculturally, which was their life, every aspect was supposed to be let go. It was supposed to be left alone. He uses two words here. The first we have interpreted, let it rest. The second one, lie fallow. It means to let it go and leave it alone. Literally, it means to release it, to take your hands and drop it. Later in the book of Leviticus, God is going to remind his people that the land, though it's your inheritance, it still belongs to me. It's my land. I'm giving you stewardship of it, ownership. But the idea of ownership is being entrusted with something from God that's from him and for him. So it's still God's in the last place, still God's in the first place. The land belongs to God. And what happens that seventh year is I'm letting it go and reminding myself and everybody around me that everything I have belongs, in fact, to God. Now, it's pretty easy for us to say that, isn't it? Everything I have belongs to God. But it's really hard when God decides to take it out of my hands. Everything I have belongs to God. This is God's. Let me have mine. No, this is yours. Let me have it. No, you can't have it. And that, in fact, this year of release, the word is actually used for this sabbatical year. It's called the year of letting go, the year of release. It's an inconvenience. It's a costly obedience. The whole point here is so that the poor may eat. In other places, it's so that the land can be rejuvenated. But here, the primary purpose is so that those who are poor may eat. That is, so that those who know want might have no wants. And we know that's exactly the purpose because it's demonstrated in verse 11. It says, so what they leave behind can be eaten by animals. I don't want you to go back into your field, the thing that you've let go and left it alone. After the poor come in and take everything that they want. In fact, they've taken so much that they can't take anymore, and they're leaving stuff behind now. They've taken everything that they can take. I don't want you to go back into the field and grab the little leftovers that they left behind. That goes to the animals. Are you serious? I'm taking care of my animals as well. God is reminding his people that he owns everything, and it all belongs to him. This is a terrible inconvenience. It's a costly obedience. But the only way that they can experience God's rich blessing is if they're willing to obey even though it costs. Oh, it's easy to obey when it doesn't cost us very much. It's easy to obey when I can give God the leftovers. But when I have to give God the first fruits, ay, ay, ay. How do I know more's coming? When I have to give God the best, and he's going to emphasize both of those aspects later on in this text, that's costly. It's an obedience that's costly. It's also an obedience that's regular. You see that the next portion, verse 12, 6 days you shall do your work, but on the seventh day of every week, you're supposed to rest. We've seen this back in chapter 20 in the Ten Commandments. Again, the word rest here breaks the economic rhythm. And it means literally to stop, cease. It's the patrolman standing in the road with a whistle in his mouth. Can't go forward. It's Sabbath day. Yeah, but nope. It's Sabbath day. And the point isn't that this is a burden. It's a, oh, good. Because the idea is not just stop. The next word that he uses there, so that your beast, your ox, and your donkey may have rest, is the idea of being able to relax, of being quiet, of settling down. It's of taking that burden. We've been making our way down life's road with that burden on our back, carrying out our responsibilities, doing what we're supposed to do. But it gets heavy. It gets long. All of a sudden, the policeman sticks his hand in our face and blows his whistle, says, stop! And the nice thing is, we don't have to stop while holding our burden. The whole idea of the stop is to drop it. I don't know if you've ever been moving somebody. My favorite thing to move is pianos. The only thing is because when you finally set it down, it's really, really nice. But you're in the middle of moving that piano. You're in the middle of moving that couch. You're in the middle of moving one of those hide-a-beds. You're wrestling it around the corner, and all of a sudden, the guy has an itch, like in his ear. Oh, wait a minute. Set it down. Oh, gladly. Funk. itch. Okay, pick it up again. You know what? Monday, we pick it up again. For them, it was Sunday. Pick it up again. Keep on going. But the idea of the Sabbath wasn't to be an inconvenience. It wasn't to be a nag. It was to be a blessing. Because God knew that life gets tough. It's filled with responsibility. Man was designed for work. But ever since the fall, that work became toilsome. It became troublesome. And so while we're striving underneath life's responsibilities, God says, why don't you take time to set it down? Why don't you get your eyes off your sandal straps and look up and see there's clouds in the sky. There's birds in the air. Why don't you lift up your eyes and see that the fields are green? There's daisies growing in the grass. Why don't you watch the lambs skip for a bit? Why don't you listen to the birds sing? And it was time to be able to remember that life's crushing load wasn't all there is to life. But there's a God behind it all who orders it. It's a weekly rest meant for everybody to be rested, both their ox and their donkey, he focuses on. But then he uses another word and he speaks to another group. He uses a word called nefash, which is tied in with the idea of the soul or the breath. And he applies it to the servant woman's son and the alien. These are like not just the servant, but her strapling, her little kid, the one who's of no economic value to you whatsoever. He doesn't increase your pocketbook by one penny. But even he deserves a break. The alien who's not necessarily a part of your community, and yet he's chosen to live among you, to worship the same God, though he doesn't have an inheritance per se in the land, he deserves a break as well. And the word nefash means he gets to catch his breath. Or even more literally, to have breath restored to him. It's of taking that breath and getting what he needs to go the next leg of the journey. Having more life breathed in. We've all been there. When life actually just sucks the breath out of you, God says, you know what I'm going to do for you? I want to order your time in such a way so that you're stopping. You're letting go. You're dropping off. You're setting down. You're breathing again. You're ordering life, not in light of life's circumstances, but in light of obedience to me. A costly obedience. A regular obedience. Every week you're supposed to do this. We see, thirdly, it's a careful obedience. We come to verse 13, and it doesn't seem to fit. But he says, pay attention to all that I've said to you. I want you to listen up. I don't want you to listen to the competing voices in your life. We know that this is one of the first things that God addresses to Adam. He says, Adam, why did you listen to the voice of your wife rather than listening to what I told you to do? You know what? God says to his people, be careful, listen, pay attention. There's other voices that will be actively calling out to you. There's other things that would grab your attention and take your eyes off the prize. Don't listen to them. Be careful to keep in focus the things that I've told you. Pay attention to all that I've told you to do, to all that I've said. This is a complete obedience. I don't know about you, but I make a pretty good jackrabbit. I can start well. I just have a hard time finishing. I think most of us can do that. We can start well, but we don't keep on keeping on, keeping on, keeping on. God says, listen, the only way you're going to reach the end, the only way you're going to do all that I commanded you is if you're careful to take care of the little details along the way. You're blocking out those voices that would take away your attention, and you're focusing only on me, one step at a time, one step at a time, one step at a time. We see then that it's an obedience that is exclusive. He says, pay attention to all I've said to you and make no mention of the names of other gods. Don't even let their names be heard on your lips. As God is ordering this life for this covenant community, he's ordering them in light of a covenant that he's drawing with them. But the whole purpose, remember, of God calling out the Israelites was so that they might be a blessing to the nations. Back in Genesis, when God created man, he blessed him. That blessing was forfeited under the fall. Then we see that the blessing is restored after Noah. The blessing is brought to a specific man, Abraham. It's passed down to Isaac. It's passed down to Jacob. Esau forfeits the blessing. Jacob does everything so he can obtain the blessing. He doesn't do it the right way, but he values it more than Esau does, and the blessing transfers with Jacob. God takes his people down into Egypt, but before sending them there, he sends Joseph so that they can be blessed in the land of Egypt. God had told Abraham from the beginning that through you, all nations on earth will be blessed. And so as God brings them out into the wilderness, redeeming them from their slavery, ordering them, sanctifying them for his purposes, his purpose is to bless them and then through them to bless others. The only way to obtain God's blessing is through obedience. An obedience that's costly. An obedience that's regular. An obedience that's careful. An obedience that's exclusive, because no other God can afford you the life that God can offer you. So when we look at Jesus' promise in John 10:10, I have come that they might have life and that they might have it, what? Abundantly. Okay? He's not necessarily talking a fat wallet. He's not even necessarily talking about green grass and fields. He's not even talking necessarily permanent employment. He's talking peace in the midst of the storm. He's talking surely goodness and mercy chasing you down all the days of your life, so that no matter whether you're in a concentration camp or you've just inherited a gold mine from your grandfather, in any circumstance, Paul says, I know how to abound. I know how to suffer. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And that's the idea. I can be consistent. I can live the good life whether I have much or whether I have nothing at all. But God's the only one who can give me this kind of life. And God says, don't even talk about other gods. Don't put them on your lips. The idea is, don't draw attention to them by articulating their names. We're so foolish sometimes. We cause our own problems by stimulating ideas and discussion and things that we really don't even have any business talking about. Paul says, when he's talking about sexual sins in the New Testament, he says, it's a shame to even talk about those things. Just avoid them and don't even talk about them. And that's what God says about these gods. He says, don't learn their names, don't learn their customs. Avoid them, because I'm the only God that can give you this kind of life. As God calls his people into this life of blessing, this abundant life, he wants them to order their life in such a way that it takes time to understand that this abundant life comes only through grace, yes, but my side of the coin requires effort in obedience. The second thing that God wants us to see is that it takes time to understand the abundant life is contingent upon personal application of this blessing. God wants to bless us. The blessing's available. The blessing's there. It's purchased. It's bought. It's stuck out in front of us. Now, it's ours to unwrap. It's ours to apply. It's ours to take as our own. Brueggemann notes that Genesis 2, 1 through 4, the very first thing that God sets apart within creation as holy is time. That seventh day God blessed and made it holy. He set it apart. He sanctified it. That's how the Sabbath is given in the Ten Commandments. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. The first thing that God sanctifies within creation is time itself. Brueggemann continues, these laws now culminate with a calendar of festivals urging that Israel takes time to be holy. Taking time to be made whole. This festival ritual is a regular, disciplined demonstration of loyalty to their God, acknowledging that life comes from him alone and life belongs to him alone. The community is enjoined to treat time as holy, both in order to value creation and to honor the Creator. All of these times intend to break the conventional economic practice of working, getting, spending, ingathering, harvest. The festivals are an act of faith because they make an ordered acknowledgement that prevents human business from degenerating into endless effort at management, success, and self-security. God is giving them a calendar of festivals. Well, that's pretty interesting. So often, when you're talking to your friend at work, your buddy across the street, when you're talking to people on the subway, on the train, you talk to them and they think of this God as, oh, you're a Christian. That means you can't, you can't, you can't. You have to, you have to, you have to. You know what our God schedules for his people? He says, here's what's really important. I don't want you to forget this. Have festivals. I want you to celebrate. I want you to learn to smile, to sing. The idea is to dance. The feasts, he calls them. The term means a pilgrim celebration. It includes a meal. All of us are like, yeah, thumbs up, okay? God wants us to be eating together. It also means the word times that he uses here has the idea of foot. They're pilgrim festivals that would take place on foot, and they would present themselves three times a year in the city of Jerusalem in God's presence. These feasts or festivals are surrounded with terminology that means leaping, dancing, singing. The purpose of these festivals is to celebrate the life under God's blessing. That's the purpose. So God says, this is really important. Regularly, you're dropping your burden, you're catching your breath. Once every 7 years, you're letting go, reminding yourself and everybody else that everything you have belongs to me. But three times every year, I want you to dance and sing and celebrate and taste and eat and remember how good life is because of how good I am. That's the whole point. And he wants them to be regular in it. We see that there's the blessing of sanctification. First, he comes to him, he says, I want you to observe the feast of unleavened bread. Verse 15, you shall keep the feast of unleavened bread, as I commanded you, you shall eat unleavened bread for 7 days at the appointed time in the month of Abib. Because, now this is the reason, because in this month you came out of Egypt. Remember, we've tied it in, God tied it in for us back in Exodus chapter 12. This 7 day feast of unleavened bread followed the 1 day celebration of Passover. Passover is the entry point. Passover is the redemption. Passover is where the price is paid for these people to be free. Following right on the heels of that Passover celebration, the next day, they're freed not to live as they want, but they're freed to be sanctified, to be separated, to live unto God, not to live unto themselves. So now they've exchanged the taskmaster Pharaoh for a new master, Yahweh. The idea of that unleavened bread, remember how Ryken had explained it for us earlier. The way that they made bread in those days, they didn't have yeast packets. They would use a pinch of old dough, the friendship bread that we have today, where you have that starter lump, and you're able to take that and mix it in with your new stuff so that it's able to rise and spread and so on. But the idea is God says, listen, the life that you've had, I don't want there to be a continuity at all between the new life you have and the old life you lived. They're incongruous. On that day, you came out of Egypt. But the whole idea of the Unleavened Bread Festival is to get Egypt out of you. This is brand new. And I want you to celebrate this because I want you to remember, get all the leaven out. As you celebrate this festival, no leaven, nothing permeating, because I want you to understand that there's no connection whatsoever with being what you are today as my child and what you used to be as a slave of the devil. They're incongruous. They don't go along together. So he says, I want you to enter into this feast of unleavened bread so that you get to understand the separation, the sanctification that belongs to you. He has two other feasts for us. Feasts that fit on the calendar year. The unleavened bread fits up for us right about in March, but it was the beginning of their year. The Feast of Weeks, or this Feast of Harvest called Pentecost, and then this Feast of Tabernacles. He's going to call it the Feast of Ingathering in just a moment, but you can see where they fit on the calendar year. The second one he calls the Feast of Harvest. It's this blessing of initiation. It's where the first fruits are acknowledged by God. In Leviticus 23, verses 10 and 11, this first fruits were offered to God the day after the Sabbath. What's the day after the Sabbath? Sabbath is Saturday, so the day after the Sabbath is Sunday. First fruits come on Sunday. Ah, interesting. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 20 says that Jesus Christ was brought forth from the dead as a first fruit. What day did Jesus Christ rise from the dead? The day after the Sabbath. Ah, Jesus is a first fruits in God's economy. Jesus is the very first to come to life of so many more that will come to life. 50 days later, after this first fruits offering, count out 7 weeks and one day, 50 days later, you come to the Feast of Harvest, otherwise called Pentecost in the New Testament. This feast is unique in that it's the only feast that allows leavened bread to be brought. It's a feast that includes, you've harvested already, you bake it, and you wave these two loaves before the Lord. And the idea is, it's a first harvest. It's an early harvest. It's a harvest that anticipates more harvest yet to come. Interesting, on the day of Pentecost, 50 days after the first fruits, we have 3,000 souls are the beginning of the ingathering of the harvest of souls of the new covenant. An amazing thing, the way God puts this all together. There's one more feast that he focuses on. It's a feast of ingathering. If the Feast of Harvest was the initiation of the blessing, the Feast of Ingathering is the completion of the blessing. It's that time in the fall where the harvest is done. The combines are going out of the field. The silos are full. The dryers are humming. Verse 17 is the blessing of inclusion. You all appear. All of your males, 3 times a year. I want you to come and be a part of, to be included in, to join your voices in, to join your feet in the dancing. I want you to experience what I have in store for every one of my people. It's at that point, and God says, now listen, end of verse 15, none shall appear before me empty-handed. None shall appear before me empty-handed. Verse 17 says, everyone must appear before me, but none will appear before me empty-handed. Verses 18 and 19 develop for us how it is that God's people are supposed to appear before God, not empty-handed, but ready to give an offering, and what kind of offering it is that they're supposed to give. Kind of strange. Don't offer blood with anything leavened. Okay, well, we get that. Don't let the fat of my feast remain until morning. Well, we get feast, whatever. 19, the best of the first fruits you bring into the house of the Lord, but don't boil a young goat in its mother's milk. All right, well, that was a blessing. Okay, now let's go read John 3:16, right? And that's how we treat these passages, like, yeah, didn't quite get that. Where's something that I can chew on? Something I can enjoy. Verse 18a. He says, I don't want you to mix that which brings cleansing with that which brings defilement. The blood of the sacrifice cannot be mixed with the leaven that contaminates. The one makes clean, the other makes dirty. They don't go together. Okay, we get that. The second one, 18b. I don't want you to let the fat remain until morning. When we're talking about fat today, we're thinking cholesterol, we're thinking heart attacks, we're thinking avoid it at all costs. That's not the way the Bible presents the fat in the Old Testament in particular. The fat is the rich, the flavorful. And Leviticus 7, verses 23 through 25, reminds us that the fat of the offering belongs exclusively to God. It was not meant for human consumption. Here in verse 18, it tells us not to treat negligently that which belongs to God exclusively. Don't set it off to the side and leave it till morning when it's the best and belongs to God as the very first. Don't treat negligently that which belongs to God exclusively, and don't bring delinquently that which belongs to God immediately. Verse 19a, the best of the first fruits of your ground you bring into the house of the Lord your God. That is, I don't offer that which is less to the one who deserves my best. This goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 4, where Abel brings the fat of his flock, is how Genesis 4 says it. He brought the very best of what he had. Cain, on the other hand, brought some fruit. Any old fruit. Leftover fruit? Whatever. He just brought some fruit. But the Bible goes out of the way to say, Abel brought the very best of what he had. Cain brought stuff because he had to bring stuff. God says, listen, I'm making you a people that I'm dumping life into. Everything you have belongs to me because everything you have came from me. Now, is it too much for me to ask for your very best? Oh, that's really good, Pastor. The people back then should have given their best. I'm not talking about people back then. It's so easy for us to deflect this. Do you give your best to God? What does that look like? In what arenas does that mean? How about the best part of your day? How about the best part of your time? How about the best part of your energies, your resources, your monies? The last thing he says, the fourth thing, don't boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Okay. Well, Orthodox Jews took this to mean that they couldn't have dairy and meat in the same meal. So they just wouldn't. They'd either eat dairy or they'd eat meat. And they're being very literal about what it said. It's not what he's getting at. Alter says it this way. He calls it the promiscuous joining of life and death. The idea is don't confuse that which ministers death with that which is divinely intended for life. He's talking about milk and meat. You've got a dead meat kid. Don't cook a dead meat goat in the milk that was meant to nourish its life. And he's not just talking about some dietary law. The fact that these aren't just some obscure laws is indicated by there's a pattern in which these things are given. The first thing given in verse 18, blood and leaven, has the idea of the ransom blood, which brings life. The permeating leaven, which brings death. Okay, that's how he starts it. He ends it up with the dead meat kid, the life-nourishing milk. He's talking about life and death and life and death. Don't mix life with death. Don't bring into your walk with me that which draws out and sucks down the life that I've intended to give you. Those middle two things, the idea of the fat being the best and the best of the first fruits, are the good stuff that you're supposed to give back to God. These verses, folks, remind us that in our worship, God wants us to bring to Him an offering that is unmixed in its purity. And an offering that is the very best in its quality. You know what? These are all blessings that God has given to His people. And the whole point of these festivals is to remind the people, listen, back when I brought you out of Egypt, it wasn't just a group, but it was a group of which you yourself were a part. So I want you personally to stop and take time to remember what I've done for not just y'all, but you. For you. And then I want you to understand that what you have is just the beginning of what I want to give you. And then I want you to understand when you come and you're sated and you're full and there's so much that you can't hold it all, I want you to acknowledge that it comes from me and that I'm a God who loves to bless. Worship. Worship is that regular time with God that lifts us routinely above the towering circumstances of life. I love this picture. These are trees. These are big trees. But bigger than the trees is this place of worship. You know what? God can do that for you. You feel pressed down by what life has to offer? Let me ask you something. How's your worship? Because worship and stress and worry and frustration can't exist in the same heart at the same time. They just can't. It's this worship then that fits us for a calling that's high. To live as the people of God. Because even in the Old Testament, the most important thing that God's people could do was to worship well. You know what? That's true for us today. We've got to make worship an important part of what we regularly do. Does it take time? Yes. Why do we dress up in suits and ties? Because we like being uncomfortable? No. Because we like looking professional? No. We don't do it because of anything that has to do with us. We do it so that we can be a part of giving our best to God and showing others that our God is worth taking the time to get dressed up for. We do this week after week, year after year, because our God is worth it, and He wants us to order our lives in such a way that life doesn't crush us and press us down, because as soon as we forget God, life will do that for us. My friend, today, if you feel like you're being crushed, like you're being pressed down, you can't afford it, but you can't afford not to take the time to worship. Let's pray.